how can we help guide people to live better lives, to improve the potential to live the life you want? Instead of struggling, using all your willpower to try to eat less, what if you could eat foods that you love as much as you like, as much or as little as you like, and then just be happy and content and have all your willpower to achieve whatever is important to you in your life?
Welcome to the Drew Perrott Podcast. Each week, we explore the inner workings of the brain and the body with one of the brightest minds in wellness, medicine, and mindset. This week's guest is Dr. Andreas Ehnfeldt, also called and known as Dr. E. And he's here to talk about why satiety could be the missing link in your weight loss journey. And he's going to break down the top foods that encourage you to be full, causing you not to want to eat, and the top culprits, the top foods that keep you hungry and are designed to make you want to eat more. Now, a little bit more about Dr. E. Dr. E is a Swedish-based medical doctor who specializes in family medicine. He's also the founder and CEO of the website Diet Doctor and the soon-to-be-released app Hava. During the last 10 years, Dr. E has authored the biggest health blog in Sweden and a number one best-selling book on nutrition titled Low Carb, High Fat Food Revolution, Advice and Recipes to Improve Your Health and Reduce Your Weight. That's been translated to over 8 languages, including English. Dr. E graduated from medical school in the year 2000 at Uppsala University. He spent 12 years working as a doctor and 8 of those years as a family physician, treating patients with a low carb approach, focusing on their metabolic health. During that time, he witnessed amazing success stories for people with obesity and type 2 diabetes. Stay tuned for a fantastic episode on satiety with Dr. E, and specifically what to eat to stay full and what to avoid that will help you prevent constant hunger. Dr. E, welcome to the podcast. It's a pleasure to have you here. I'd love to jump right in. You know, your mission is to really make a major dent in the obesity crisis. And a big way that you're doing that is you've developed an algorithm to help people lose weight. We're going to break that algorithm down. But first, give us an idea from that lens of satiety. What are some of the lowest scoring foods, the foods that are so addictive that they keep people eating and they make it harder to lose weight on their weight loss journey?
Sure. Thank you, Drew. Great to be here. I'd be happy to do that. I think the main concept is that some foods make you want to eat more and some foods make you want to eat less. So just counting calories doesn't really cut it. You need to sort of eat the right foods and then it becomes easy. So when we talk about the lowest satiety foods, those foods are the ones that make you want to eat as much as possible. And basically this is the goal of the food industry, the processed food industry, right? Because that's where the profit is. The more they make you eat, the more you come back and buy their food. So generally speaking, we're talking about ultra processed foods that have some sort of addictive combination of, let's say, sugar and fat. Donuts, for example, might score a 1 out of 100. You can also think of chocolate bars, a Mars bar, for example, be at the very, very, very bottom. Potato chips might score slightly higher, maybe 3, 4, 5 on our score up to 100. And basically anything you can think of when you have had a big dinner and you're really full and you're like, well, what could I eat now? And when I asked people on Twitter, most of them said the most popular answer was ice cream. And that also scores at the very, very bottom of the satiety scale. So it tends to be those kind of foods, salt, sugar, fat together, mostly sugar and fat.
Yeah. And it's not just traditional, regular store-bought ice cream. It's also keto ice cream. And we're going to do a whole breakdown into some of the common keto foods that are out there that people might be eating that actually cause a lot of hunger and keeping people reading. Let's zoom out for a second. And let's start off with the idea that what is satiety and why do people have such a hard time deciding what to eat and when they're full?
Right. So satiety, the easiest way to think of it is it's the opposite of hunger. So you're hungry, you want to eat, you think about food all the time, you have all kinds of cravings, you imagine what kind of foods would be good for you. And if you walk by something that looks nice, you're likely to want to pick it up and eat it. If you have satiety, it's the opposite. You are now content, you're happy, you're not interested in food. And if you walk past something that looks delicious, you might not even notice because your mind is directed at other things. If you get bored, if you get sad, if you get angry, irritated, you're not thinking about foods to calm or you know, make yourself feel better. You might think of talking to a friend, watching some Netflix, whatever it may be that comes to mind, but it's not going to be food that's top of mind for you. But if you are hungry, you know, that's what's going to pop into your mind. So think of satiety as the opposite of hunger. Now, the interesting thing is that you can, of course, get satiety from eating any kind of food. You can eat, if you eat enough ice cream, you will eventually stop being interested in eating more. You're going to be so full that, you know, you don't even want ice cream anymore. But that's a lot of calories until you get there. At least for me, you know, I can eat a lot of ice cream if I get started. So there is a difference from one food to the next in how much satiety do you get per calorie? Like, how much would you eat out of this food until you're full and no longer interested? And if you think of a food like a boring kind of fitness food like chicken breast, once you've eaten a certain amount of chicken breast, you're not going to be all that interested in eating more. It's actually got quite high satiety per calorie. But if you have a tray of different donuts in front of you, you might eat a lot more. Maybe you would end up eating 1500 calories of chicken breast in a day. But if you only ate donuts all day, maybe you'd eat 4000 calories. I mean, the difference can be pretty massive, actually.
This episode is brought to you by Element, L-M-N-T. Element is an electrolyte mix that's on par with everything that I look for in a high-quality electrolyte supplement. Number one, super clean ingredients. Number two, free from added sugars. Number three, zero artificial sweeteners. I love using Element first thing in the morning before I hit the gym for an intense workout, and I'm a big fan of using it before my sauna sessions too, because I lose a ton of electrolytes in my sweating sessions. And as we've heard from many past podcast guests, replenishing with electrolytes is the key to keeping your brain and body hydrated for optimal performance. That's why I'm so big on my morning hydration protocol, which you guys have heard me talk about on this podcast before. What I love about Element is that each of their 8 flavors are loaded with sodium, potassium, and magnesium in ratios that are backed by science. My personal favorite flavor is watermelon, but honestly, all of their flavors are super delicious. Right now, Element is offering my listeners a free sample pack with any purchase, so you can try all 8 of their flavors and pick your favorite, or you can share them with a friend or a loved one. Head over to drinkelement.com/Drew, that's drink, D-R-I-N-K, Element, LMNT.com/DHRU, to claim this offer from my community today. This episode is brought to you by Whoop. Now, everyone can agree that exercise is legit one of the greatest tools in our toolbox for longevity. And Dr. Sarah Godfrey, Cynthia Thurlow, and many other guests on my podcast and experts in hormonal health have shared that there is such a thing as overdoing it and overtraining without recovery, especially for women. So how do you know when you're doing too much or when you can push your body just a little bit harder? That's where Whoop comes in. Whoop is a digital fitness wearable that monitors your physiology 24/7 and gives you real-time insights into your sleep, strain, and recovery, and so much more with their app's revolutionary coaching and feedback system. Whoop calculates your perfect and personalized plan for the day by measuring your heart rate variability, respiratory heart rate, and other key metrics. Gone are the days of not knowing how to gauge your workouts. Whoop helps take the guesswork out of your fitness routine so you can always show up and give your body what it needs. If you want real-time insights into your health and fitness routine with less burnout and quicker results, you gotta try Whoop. head on over to join.whoop.com/Drew to get your first month free. First month free on Whoop. That's join.whoop, WHOOP.com/DHRU for your first month free of Whoop.
Yeah, absolutely huge. You know, when I think about your work and as I was starting to learn about it and of course follow you on Twitter, the thing that came to mind to me was a quote that you were saying. You said, calories count, but you don't have to count them. There's a much better way. And to extend that quote, the idea is satiety is that way, and satiety has these different levers. If we understand how to pull the levers in the right sort of combination, not only do we tend to not overeat, but it doesn't require a lot of willpower to do that. We just feel full, and that puts us in a place of contentment. When we're content, we don't overeat. When we don't overeat, we don't end up gaining weight. So just like we started off in the beginning and you gave us a list of a few foods that are the lowest ranking, which is a bad thing, chocolate chips, cookies, potato chips. Give us a little bit of a contrast as we're building this sort of foundation for everybody to follow. What would be some examples of higher scoring foods that tend to keep people full, but also provide them with enough energy to continue doing the work that they need to do in the day?
Right. And there you basically end up with unprocessed whole foods of pretty much all kinds. So you can imagine protein-rich foods in particular tends to be quite satiating, and that could be from animal sources like meat, fish, eggs, etc. But you can also find vegetarian sources of protein such as beans, lentils, tofu, seitan, and different kinds of high protein products like that. Vegetables tends to be extremely high satiety per calorie, but of course you're not gonna feel full from eating some broccoli. It's more like a thing you can eat together with something else to ramp up, increase the overall satiety of the meal. You're probably not going to be full from just eating leafy green vegetables, but it's a great combination with it. So just to sort of think of it as a whole concept, unprocessed foods tend to be higher protein foods, higher fiber foods, foods with lower energy density, meaning it has fewer calories for a specific weight, is usually, again, an attribute that unprocessed foods have, while ultra-processed packaged foods, they are often the moisture is taken out of it, the water is taken out of it, it's sort of concentrated calories. Think of potato chips, for example. It's dry, it's all carbs and fat in a concentrated format that's very energy dense, and it has low satiety. The final factor that is a little bit more controversial, and there is less research, but it's clearly a major factor still, is something we call the hedonic factor. Some people talk about highly rewarding foods or hyper-palatable foods. And this is also often an attribute of ultra-processed foods that the food industry really tries to maximize, because here's where you can get massive profits. If you combine sugar and fat together, especially in foods that are low in protein and high in energy density, that sort of really fires up the dopamine, the reward circuits in our brain, and we just cannot resist it once we start eating it. Here you have things like, again, chocolate, ice cream, donuts. There are other factors that also can drive these sort of reward circuits in the brain. And salt is one of those things. If you combine salt with high fat foods or high carb foods, then that can also become quite hedonic. Think of nuts, for example. if you have plain nuts.
Yeah, there's a whole debate on Twitter about macadamia nuts on your thread.
Yeah.
People saying, is it good? Is it not good? So why is everybody debating macadamia nuts? Tell us about that.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, if you come at it from a low carb angle, I mean, I used to be I'm still a low carber, I would say, but I used to believe that low carb was the way for everybody, pretty much. You know, lower carb always better, kind of. And now I think it's more complicated. But I'm still very positive to low carb. I think it's a great tool to use. A very simple approach that tends to lead people in the right direction. But yeah, nuts is controversial, I think, because if you come at it from a low carb angle, they look really good. They are low carb. Macadamia nuts, for example, super low carb, and you think, oh well, that's great then. You can eat lots of macadamia nuts and lose weight and improve your diabetes and so forth. And yet there is this controversy around them, because I've been in this field for 20 years, and for this entire time, when I've heard all these experts, all these experienced people saying, you know, if you struggle to lose weight on low carb, cut down on nuts, don't eat so many nuts, and also eat less dairy. Those are the sort of two things that people have always been saying. And it's like, there is no good explanation. Why is that? Because they are low carb. And yet, if you look at it from a satiety lens, now it makes perfect sense, because nuts actually are among the lowest satiety foods of all low carb foods. Of all common low carb foods, they are among the lowest. Why? Well, because they are very high fat, and they're low in protein, low in nutrition, and they're very highly energy dense. And again, if you come back to what I came into this through, was this hedonic factor. If you also put salt on them, you make, you know, roasted salted nuts, now they get quite difficult to stop eating, because there is this effect that happens in the human brain when you combine something that is high salt and high fat together. It becomes very rewarding. We really like it, and we tend to eat more than we may need. So yeah, there's been a lot of debate online. Nuts, are they good or bad for weight loss? I would say not good.
You know, tell us a little bit about your evolution. You talked about being low carb, and that was sort of a little bit of I believe you read a book by Gary Tobbs that kind of got you started on this journey. Good calories, bad calories, or I forget the exact name of it. And over a period of time, you founded this hit website, you wrote a book. The website is the Diet Doctor website. What got you to start shifting your point of view? And what are some core areas that you sort of changed your mind on when it came to food? You mentioned you still practice a low carb approach in your life, but what sort of fundamental things did you start giving more weight to as the evidence around you started to change?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've been doing this for 20 years now, but I came at it from a sort of low glycemic index diet kind of thing, and then I got more and more into low carb. And you mentioned this book by Gary Tobbs, which was quite influential for a lot of people. I thought it was pretty amazing, and I think it still is, but I don't no longer agree with everything in it. I think that the fundamental idea that Gary Tobbs and other people in the low carb and researchers in the low carb area have been traditionally focused on is that carbohydrates, they break down to sugar in the blood. You take it up as sugar into the blood, and that leads to the release of the hormone insulin to take care of this sugar. And insulin is also a fat storing hormone. So that means that eating carbohydrates raises your blood sugar and raises this fat-storing hormone, and therefore you store fat, and therefore you gain weight. And then the solution is to eat fewer carbohydrates, and that's that. And it seems to be supported by the fact that there are dozens of high-quality studies testing low-carbohydrate diets that actually show that it does work for people. And of course, we know this from our experience. There are lots of people online and offline and anywhere who've been trying various low carb approaches probably for 150 years. It's been off and on popular. Clearly it works, right? But the real interesting question to me is why does it work? Because the thing that has made me sort of update my view on this is primarily that there are also a number of black swans. There are a number of examples where the low carb theory does not explain reality. And in the last 5 years or so, there's also been a number of well done studies that are very hard to explain using a low carb sort of insulin focused lens. So it seems that it's actually more complicated than that. Low carb, yes, it works. We know that, but we don't know quite why yet. It does not seem to be all about the insulin. That's for sure. And talking about these black swans, I mean, one that comes up quite a bit is, well, what about traditional people in Asian countries, in China and other Asian countries, living primarily on rice, a very carb focused eating pattern, and yet they traditionally didn't have obesity, didn't have metabolic disease. You know, there are a lot of people that also never really had access to modern foods, like the Ketavans, the Hadza people, lots of indigenous people living traditional lifestyles, usually eating like 50% or more of their energy from carbohydrates, and yet virtually nobody had obesity, nobody had high blood pressure. They were super healthy from a metabolic perspective. Of course, they might get, you know, infections or accidents and die early from other reasons, but they didn't get our Western chronic diseases that we get, and yet they were eating carbohydrates. And then added to that, then a number of studies from the last few years that are very hard to explain. For example, there is one called Diet Fits, one of the biggest studies to test a low carbohydrate diet versus a higher carb diet, trying to make the difference as big as possible. 600 people participated, and well, they both lost lots of weight. They lost equal amounts of weight whether they went low carb or high carb. It is very hard to explain that using insulin. So, and there are other studies too. I won't bore you with all the examples, but there's a long line of black swans that cannot be explained with insulin.
Yeah, I think it's important to address because, of course, you as a metabolic, as a background in metabolic health and also being a medical doctor, partly what I'm hearing from you is that, great, okay, we know that low carb is a tool that works for a lot of people. There's some people that also are not low carb that still, from these studies that you mentioned, can maintain a good healthy weight or lose weight. But then on the flip side, there's also many people that are practicing quote unquote low carb, but because they're eating primarily foods, or even people that, a lot of people that are on this podcast, I get emails all the time. People write in and say, look, I'm eating a healthy diet. I'm not eating a diet of donuts, cookies, chips. I'm not eating all these foods on a regular basis, maybe a birthday cake here or there. But when you look at your algorithm of protein, energy density, fiber, hedonic factors, you see even for them, even with them eating healthy, a lot of their foods are a little bit out of whack. They're concentrated almond butters that are a huge base of their diet. They are super energy dense, health food processed snacks that are there. You know, they may not potato chips, but they're cassava chips, you know, with avocado oil and sea salt, which tastes great, right? And I'm glad that those are available. But when that becomes the base of your diet, that now starts to take you in a different direction, even if you eat really healthy. And also what you're saying is that, you know, these other societies, of course, there's other factors, how active they are, etc. But we can't just look at it and say low carb works for all. There's got to be more to it. And that's what you're trying to explore with the satiety approach, that, hey, there's many roads to Rome. There's different ways to get you to satiety. But if we don't, regardless of what the approach is, even if somebody's vegan, if we don't keep satiety in mind, quickly we can start to get off track. So let's run a couple scenarios just to kind of make it tangible for the audience. What would be an example of somebody who's eating? I grew up eating a plant-based diet. I grew up vegetarian, primarily for religious reasons. My family was Hindu. We were vegetarian, even though my parents said, you know, I could change my mind at any time. Then later on, again, primarily from religious animal rights reasons, I got off of dairy because I had really bad acne. It actually helped my skin a lot. And then I was like, wow, I found the ultimate, you know, fix for everything. Everybody's got to be vegan. And I went down that pathway. So if somebody's doing a plant-based vegan approach and it's not working for them, and let's say they're gaining weight or they don't, you know, feel good, what would be some examples of how their satiety scoring on their day-to-day life would be a little bit out of whack that would cause them to overeat? Because I know a ton of, you know, overweight and not healthy, you know, especially body composition wise, vegetarians and vegans. So what would be some examples of some things that would take them off track?
Sure, absolutely. I would just comment on the fact that you can actually think of this satiety per calorie concept, at least in theory. I mean, I'm not saying that our take on it is perfect yet. It's a work in progress, right? But you can, in theory, you can use this to explain, why is it that that all kinds of diets work? How can, you know, some people be losing weight and getting really healthy on a vegan diet, while other people lose weight and get really healthy on a carnivore diet? They are doing the opposite, and yet they are both successful. Or in some cases, like what you said, someone else is on a vegan diet and they don't do particularly well. I think that this
it's like when you pay attention to satiety, it can take you to the right path regardless of the approach. But that same thing, if you do the opposite, whether you're vegan, carnivore, something else,
exactly,
it can take you in the other direction.
Exactly. I mean, you can use this lens and this way of looking at foods, whether you eat Mediterranean food or Mexican foods, vegan or carnivore. You know, you can eat home-cooked meals or just at fast food restaurants. Not saying that that's a recommended place to go, but, you know, if you do, you can use this in that place as well. So coming back to what you were talking about, I mean, I have enormous respect for people who eat vegan for religious or environmental concerns or animal rights concerns. I think that's entirely, worthy of a lot of respect. I'm not sure that whether something is vegan or coming from animal sources is the one and only factor to determine whether it's good for you or not. Just like, you know, whether something is high in carbohydrates or lower in carbohydrates is not the one and only thing either. So I think you can eat very healthy with a vegan approach, but you can also eat terrible with a vegan approach. So let's say, for example, well, potato chips, they can be vegan. French fries can be vegan, yet they are among the lowest satiety foods that you can think of. They're all concentrated starch and fat and almost very, very little nutrition. You can have all kinds of vegan sweets and candy and so forth, right? You can eat tons of sugar. Drinking soda, you know, that can be vegan. It's from a plant. It's from corn. Corn syrup, that's vegan, but it's terrible for your health if you drink a lot of it. So I think that you could definitely use this approach. And so I think from my perspective, a lot of people who are eating a vegetarian or vegan diet may want to look at how can you increase the amount of protein, because that may be something that is easy to not get enough of. And of course, there are plenty of sources of protein from a vegan perspective. Beans, lentils, great. All kinds of tofu or other sources of protein could be great. Eating less processed foods obviously can be beneficial. More home-cooked if possible. You know, lower energy density. Vegetables tends to score really high, so of course eating more of that could be great. But all kinds of things you could do. And what we try to do is build tools where you can just see out of the foods that you regularly eat, how do they score? You know, which ones are really low? And can we guide you to better options for you that you could maybe just switch from one thing to another, from one food that you like to another food that you like, something that is no extra effort for you, yet your body will get more satiety per calorie, you will be less hungry, you will spontaneously be eating less over the day because of it. So I think this is super exciting, whether people are vegans or whatever they are. It's fascinating to me what you can build with this.
You recently, and we'll put it on the YouTube video for those that are watching on YouTube, we'll link to it in the show notes as well. We talked a little bit about vegan. You and your team put together a matrix of sort of, as keto and sort of low carb has exploded over the last few years, you can go to Costco or Walmart or these different stores and you can get access to all sorts of different keto, you know, enhanced sort of products by big companies, you know, Hershey's and this and that. And you were trying to show that there's a lot of foods that are out there that, even though they might be marketed as a low carb, that those things are actually very low satiety and can cause you to overeat based on the matrix. Give us some examples of, I'm not asking you to like call out brands, but I do think it's helpful to like, what type of products would those be so that our audiences could listen? Because a big part of this is the marketing, and people go around and they look at something, they see it's healthy, it's a packaged food. I don't know if it would be considered ultra processed or if it would be in the processed category, probably the processed category. And we reach for these foods thinking that they could be a regular part of our life, but they could be driving a lot more overeating for many people.
Yeah. I mean, we went through a lot of processed, packaged keto or low carb foods to see what the satiety score of them were. And I would argue there actually are some decent options that some people may want to consider that could work relatively well. But there are also very, very, very bad options out there. And if you think that something is sort of healthy and a good weight loss food just because it says keto on it, then you can end up in a you might just fail pretty spectacularly. Because when we looked at things like brownie mix that was keto, or ice cream that was keto, chocolate that was zero sugar, they actually score super, super low. And what they have often done is they've removed much of the carbohydrates, but they've actually added more fat instead. And that trade may not end up being sort of, it may not make much of a difference. Like, if you remove a certain amount of carbohydrates and then you add an equal amount of energy from fat, added fat instead, that might almost be an equal trade from a sort of satiety perspective. And of course, what they do in these products is they remove the sugar and then they add artificial sweeteners instead. And that might be a slight improvement from a satiety perspective. At least you get a lower energy density and remove some of the energy from the food. So, but you still get that kind of hedonic effect, because you still have a high fat food that is also, for your brain, is very sweet. The artificial sweeteners still give the same sort of sensation or close to it. So the hedonic effect, the reward effect, might be close to the same, actually. Again, so you end up with a very slight improvement. And I mean, I've been hanging out in low carb communities, and sometimes it's like, yay, we have a low carb cheesecake here. And everybody's like, great, low carb cheesecake. Now I can eat a huge chunk of cheesecake. And you have to wonder how well that works, because often it's still extremely high in calories, extremely high in fat, almost no nutrition, almost no protein, very low satiety per calorie. And I think a lot of people who struggle to lose weight on a low carb diet, they might benefit from considering that. You know, just because someone says that a cake is low carb, it doesn't mean that it's free food, kind of. You may want to be a little bit cautious at least.
You know, one thing that I'd love you to talk about is this aspect of weight loss is one thing, right? I've never been overweight. In fact, a lot of my life, you know, I struggled to maintain a healthy weight, especially being vegan, putting on muscle. And until I switched and I'm not vegan anymore, which obviously I've shared many times, people can, I feel like you, I respect any dietary approach that people want to do. There's a lot of different ways you need to get there. I think with vegan in particular, especially because you're talking about how important protein is, it's how can you get, whether you're vegan or vegetarian, enough protein without maybe that dramatic amount of carbohydrates that typically come with those concentrated calories that are there that we all tend to, you know, veer towards. But every dietary approach has its own unique challenges. But I'd love for you to talk about weight loss is one thing, and then there's sort of optimal metabolic health, right? So do you still feel that it's important to maintain, optimal or, you know, healthy fasting insulin, for example, and other metabolic markers? And have you seen that this satiety approach still can support the optimization of these metabolic markers?
Oh, yeah, for sure. I mean, the reason I got into this wasn't about weight loss. I mean, I'm a family doctor from the beginning. I've been treating people with type 2 diabetes, hypertension, and all these metabolic issues. And what's even more important is that these are the main risk factors for the main chronic diseases that end up killing most people in the Western world prematurely, like heart disease, cancer, dementia, stroke, and on it goes. The main risk factors for these diseases are exactly these metabolic health problems: high blood sugar, high blood pressure, poor cholesterol profiles, overweight, and all of these things combined they are the main risk factors that drive this. And it doesn't just shorten people's lives, but it actually makes people's quality of life worse long before the end of our lives. So if anything, the mission that really drives me is how can we help guide people to live better lives, to improve the potential to live the life you want. Like, instead of struggling, using all your willpower to try to eat less, which is almost like a hopeless endeavor in the long term, unless you change what you eat, instead of just wasting all your willpower doing that and having all kinds of health issues pop up, what if you could eat foods that you love as much as you like, as much or as little as you like, and then just be happy and content and have all your willpower to achieve whatever is important to you in your life. That's what I want to contribute to. So weight loss is really just a way to that, because there is this very strong connection between excess abdominal fat and all of these metabolic health problems. And there is this, I think, very clear connection that the number one thing that has changed that is driving this epidemic of poor metabolic health is the food environment. I think that most people, most experts would agree with that. Today, there are, of course, any number of factors you could point to. But if you have to single out just one, that is the number one, biggest one by far, then it's most likely the food environment. And the food environment is very different today than, you know, when our grandparents or our grandparents' grandparents were around. Because the food industry has changed it, because they have had to do so, they are forced to chase profits. That's what they, you know, any public company has to increase shareholder value. They have to increase profits and bring rewards to their shareholders. That's what they're there to do. And the way to do that for the food industry is, you know, two things basically. You make the food cheaper to increase the margins on them, and that means less nutritious, because cheaper ingredients are less nutritious. And the second thing you want to do is make it so that people want to eat and buy as much as possible of it, because then you increase the revenue. And what that ends up driving is this push towards ultra-processed foods that are cheap to produce and that people want to eat as much as possible of, and then make it available everywhere and as cheap as possible, and as available as possible in as many places as possible. And then you have the perfect recipe for this epidemic of obesity and metabolic disease that is just making the whole human race, if you will, the whole humanity less than it could be, you know, reducing our potential. And the food industry cannot fix this. They are locked into this chase to ever greater profits. They have to, you know, if they try to do something else, then whoever is driving that change will be fired by their board of directors or their executives, or some other company will come in and take over if they really keep at it, right? So they can't do it. The change has to come from either from legislation, which is, I think, hard for all kinds of reasons, or it has to come from the bottom up, from people buying and eating different kinds of foods. And for that to happen, we have to make it much simpler and convenient and cheap and personalized. And, you know, so that's where we are sort of heading, that's what we've been trying to do with Diet Doctor, using a low carb approach. And now we have another brand called Hava, where we use the satiety approach, which is more flexible and I think more sustainable and more, perhaps more attractive for a broader number of people.
Yeah, there's probably a lot of people that are listening, myself included, which would, at one point in time, not anymore, it's like, just eat whole foods. Don't worry about all this packaged foods. The rest of it's going to take care of itself. And a big part of your approach with Hava, which we'll link to in the show notes, is you're trying to reach a broader audience, as you said. But for most individuals, processed foods is going to be, and even some ultra processed foods, even in places like Europe, is going to be a part of their diet. So if we really want to make a difference, we have to accept that reality and give them tools and resources to be able to decide the best options with inside of that matrix. Yes, everybody, I don't love the word should, but everybody can be encouraged towards going towards more whole foods diet. But for a lot of people, and if that's not you, you're the person that's listening, and that's not you, you definitely have family members where ultra processed foods is a regular part of their diet, or highly, highly processed foods, not just like almond butter and almond milk and, you know, things like that, but highly processed foods. So we need to come up with a solution that makes it easier for them. So I'd love to go through the matrix a little bit further and kind of break it down on each kind of point. So
could I just comment on that? Because I think that's, yes, please, so interesting. Please. I get so much pushback on Twitter and other places.
Yes. Like, so can you explain why you get pushback, right?
Yeah.
And then feel free to add
in
your
commentary. Completely agree with what you just said. I think the pushback is that we should just encourage people to eat whole foods and don't encourage people to eat ultra-processed foods. And I mean, in general, I agree with that. To the extent that people can, you know, buy whole foods ingredients and cook for themselves from scratch, I think that's always going to be the best option for whoever has the time and inclination to do that. That's going to be the most healthy diet that you can find. But just like you said, 70% of the foods in the US now are ultra processed. And to think that we can just stop eating that tomorrow, like everybody is going to stop eating that tomorrow, even though it's cheap, convenient, and tasty. And you know, the whole food industry is just going to change overnight. I think it's unfortunately not going to happen. You know, so I'm all in favor of encouraging people to cook more, to eat less processed foods. I think that's great. But just like you said, I think if we really want to be able to reach the majority of people, not just 1% or 2% or 3%, but actually most people who are interested in this, then we have to also supply options for, can we guide people to better options, even if it's still ultra processed, something that is more satiating, more nutritious, that doesn't drive metabolic disease in the same way. I think that's also, anything that's better is an improvement, right?
Yeah, anything that's better, that's an improvement. I also see people where they're coming from to stress test that idea, you know, because largely I agree with you because it's reality. I try not to argue against reality. Reality is people are eating ultra processed foods. How can we make a dent? Now, some of the folks on the other side, one of the arguments that I've heard is that, look, if ultra processed foods are some major percentage of your calories, you will never be able to get to satiety because your entire palate will always be hijacked either by the environment. As soon as you walk into McDonald's, even if you're trying to give them a better option, which by the way, I'd love to hear what's the better thing that you want them to order at McDonald's or Taco Bell or that sort of thing. I don't know if the app has
I'm not recommending to go to McDonald's, to be clear.
Yeah, you're not recommending, but we're just saying, like, you know, but in America, we're a place of fast food.
If you gunpoint, you have to eat at McDonald's. Now you have to. Okay, what should you do? Well, I think that it's pretty easy, actually. You should stay away from the sugary soda, right? If you can drink water, that's great. But, you know, artificially sweetened soda is probably way, way, way better than sugary soda. And then the other thing that is the lowest satiety food is French fries. So I would recommend maybe ditching that or taking the smallest possible serving, ideally none, and then instead going for the burgers. And then it's a question of how far do you want to go. Maybe just buy whatever burger you want. But if you want to take it one step further, maybe you add an extra burger patty that is more protein, more satiety per calorie. And if you really want to take it all the way, then you remove the bun, which some people do. And then you have sort of a salad and meat kind of dish. Now it's not so bad anymore, actually, from a satiety per calorie perspective.
Yeah, so you're adding in more protein with an extra patty, for example. You're increasing the protein percentage, which is a big part of your sort of matrix. You're upping the fiber by getting, you know, maybe whatever salad they have access to. And as a byproduct of sort of adding these things in, you're lowering the energy density by not consuming things like French fries, etc. So that would be one approach. And again, neither you or me are advocating for people to go to McDonald's. We're just saying that there are people that are going to go to McDonald's, and many of them are probably your loved ones that are listening, even if it's your second cousin or uncle or whatever that you haven't seen in a while. And we have to give them better tools. But
that is perhaps not an easy place to eat great food. But if you go to a Mexican place and you have a bowl, you know, beans and chicken and vegetables, and, you know, you can eat quite highly satiating foods at a not too expensive cost and very cheap and very fast and convenient. It's possible.
Yeah. I guess the area that a lot of people are trying to figure out is that when you are eating a lot of packaged foods as part of your diet, even packaged foods that people get from the grocery store, versus people who primarily like cook for themselves at home, are those packaged foods and is that environment, like, once you get started, can you stop, right? Once you get started eating a lot of those, that's the argument that I hear sometimes from folks, is that those foods are, that environment, those foods are so highly palatable, not if they obviously are choosing the higher satiety ones, that can they even expect that the average person is going to be able to consistently make the right choice that's there in this environment? I think the thing is, it's already happening. People are already have the base of their diets, these packaged foods. So if you can get them from going from, you know, you have this photo of crunchy granola, Nature Valley, and it has a six satiety score. We'll put the image up here. This is a food that I've seen a lot in my family members, you know, not my immediate family, not my parents and sisters and stuff, but I'll go to cousins' houses. I'll see this crunchy granola. People think that they're doing a good job. And this food has a six because it's low protein. It has a decent amount of fiber. The energy density is low, which meaning like it's high, right? And the hedonic score is very high as well. So it causes you to overeat. So if there was another packaged granola that's out there, which there are, that they could get at Costco or Walmart or something, and instead of it being a six, I've seen some that are out there that are maybe like a 30 or a 40.
Yeah.
They're doing a better job. It makes a big difference.
So, I mean, many of these, it's pretty fascinating because you can see, like you said, on the packaging, it's all natural and it's whole grains and it's this and that, and it all sounds so good for you. But then you actually look at it and it's basically sugar and fat. And and crunchy sugar and fat that you just can't stop eating. Super palatable, very addictive, yeah. So it's tricky. But I think what we do with our satiety scoring is we have a separate scoring for this hedonic factor. And you will actually be able to see if it is... because like you say, some people find it hard to stop eating these foods once they get started. And when we talk about these foods, we're usually talking about these hyper-palatable, very highly hedonic foods, these combinations of... sugar, fat, and salt, and we could help guide you to less hyper addictive foods, to some extent at least. Of course, it's always hard to break an addiction, no doubt.
Of course, as you went down this journey, well, first of all, let me just extrapolate this a little bit further. This is not some arbitrary score that you came up with, right? Tell us how you and a team put this together and what some of the influences were of the data points that led to this matrix of protein, fiber, energy density, and then, of course, the last one you mentioned, the hedonic score.
No, it's actually, we're trying to lean on, of course, this is not something that we are just doing in a vacuum here. We are leaning on what are the factors that have the strongest scientific evidence for influencing how much people want to eat. So we've been talking to a lot of researchers and scientists who've been doing these studies, looking through the literature. So Dr. Ted Nyman has really been his passion for quite some time. So he's been digging through the literature and started creating this algorithm that initially it was pretty simple, and then it just gets more and more complex over time, and we add functionality to it. And then we've been talking to a number of researchers to see, you know, what would they change? What factors would they consider to be the most evidence-based, and which ones would make a good overall combination. So from looking at the science and talking to a number of researchers, we ended up eventually with these four factors. But you know, you could imagine that we're not married to these. So if we figure out that we could add a fifth or a sixth factor to make this algorithm stronger and better predictive, then of course we'll do that. Or if one of these should go, and it's you know, exactly how do we weigh these factors against each other? Again, what we try to do there is we we look at the predicted results of our algorithm, and then we check to see, compare that to studies, randomized controlled trials with humans, where they measure ad lib intake, meaning, you know, when people get to eat as much or as little as they want from different kinds of diets, how much do they end up eating? So what we do is we look at the available data, and then we try to weigh these factors to get the result that is as close as possible to what seems like reality, right? But again, what I want to make clear is that our current system is a work in progress, and there is clearly no perfect data in the world today to say exactly which factors to combine in exactly what way and exactly how to weigh them together. That data doesn't exist. It will take a whole lot more studying to get there. But what I would argue is that even with the limited data we have, all the studies that have been made so far, we, I believe, can already make a system that is stronger and better than any individual factor on its own. Because here we're combining four different factors. In other studies, maybe they're only looking at carbohydrates, or maybe only looking at protein, or, you know, in some studies they only look at energy density, nothing else. And you can get an effect from just focusing on one factor, but it seems pretty clear that if you bake them all together, all these four factors, then you get two benefits. One is you can get an even stronger effect because you're doing more things together, not just one thing. And the second benefit is you get a more flexible approach, because if you only optimize for just one factor, then you end up with something like now you have to eat a low energy density diet, and that can be pretty bland and boring, or you can eat only a low carb diet, and that has its own drawbacks. You know, you can never eat bread, you can never eat pasta, you can never eat this and that. It becomes a bit rigid and unflexible. So I would argue that using this approach, baking this all together, you get more levers to pull, and you end up with something that is A, potentially more effective for people who struggle to reach their goals, and B, more flexible, more sustainable, more something that can fit your life, your preferences, your favorite foods, much better than any specific diet that only focuses on one thing. So to me, even though we're only kind of getting started here, to me, this is already better than anything I've seen.
And it seems largely your approach is, again, for people, you know, we're doing this summer weight loss series and body composition series. Everybody's talked about the importance of how quality matters of the food, but also total quantity in terms of the calories matter as well. And the piece that you're bringing into the equation is that, okay, great, you would agree with that too, but the calories piece for most people, you know, some of the experts that we've already had so far, some of them who you know, the typical approach is, hey, listen, you got to audit your food. So get a food scale, and at least for a couple of weeks or a month, your main meals that you have, weigh your food, put it in a calorie tracker, get a rough idea of the things that are there for you. Sure, okay, maybe some people can do that for a month. When you get that to a lot of the folks that are just focused on the energy balance side, they may say that you need to do that forever. The longer you do something that's rigid, which is part of your argument, the less likely you're going to be able to keep it up. So your thesis is that if we focus on primarily the satiety aspect, then we don't have to be thinking about counting calories as much, as long as we adhere to the principles that are there, right? So this is, I'm just kind of putting it into helping people understand. Is that a good summary? Would you add anything else to that?
Yeah, I think that's a fair summary. I would argue that very few people, I think, are able to just eat less. If you are counting calories for months and months and trying to restrict them, what you end up doing, ultimately is you figure out what foods that you can get away with eating. It's not going to be French fries and potato chips only, right? Because they are driving you to eat more. But so you do it the indirect way. Eventually, by trial and error, you figure it out. Like, I can eat lean proteins and I can eat this. And I can restrict my calories. What I would argue is that that's a very slow and painful way to do it. Why not go directly to what's causing you to overeat instead and fix that right away? And, you know, by finding these higher satiety foods that you can love and eat and, you know, enjoy life with, now you no longer have to count calories ever again, because you are eating foods that are satiating, that cause you to eat spontaneously a proper, you know, reasonable amount of calories without ever tracking it. You just eat as much or as little as you want, but you end up eating less anyways. And this may sound too good to be true, but it's not. It's been proven. You know, there is this very fascinating study, for example, by Kevin Hall, testing ultra-processed foods versus unprocessed foods with people who are locked up in this medical facility. And when people get to eat only ultra-processed foods, as much or as little as they want, they eat 500 calories more per day and gain weight. And when they eat unprocessed foods, they eat spontaneously, without counting, 500 calories less, and they start losing weight. And even though they're eating vastly different amounts of food, when they're asked, they like it as much. They feel as full, they feel as hungry, as satiated. They like the food equally much, but there is this massive difference, right? And so I'm leaning on studies like that when I say that this has been proven. If you choose foods that are more satiating, less processed, and for all these reasons that you mentioned, or some combination of it, then you no longer have to count calories. You can, in a way, eat intuitively as much or as little as you want and still be successful. The problem with eating intuitively in the general food environment we're in is that that's a disaster, right? Because all the foods have been engineered to make you overeat. And if you try to be intuitive about it, these foods are going to make you massively overeat, and you're going to end up being as obese as everybody else, which is, you know, not a good thing, unfortunately. So that doesn't work. But if you know which foods to eat now, then it can work. Now you can eat intuitively. Now you can use your brain the way it's supposed to be functioning, the way it's been shaped by evolution to guide you to the proper amounts of foods, just the right amount of foods that you need because of your individual situation, how much you've been moving today, you know, whether you have an infection in your body, how you slept, all these things. You don't have to bring out the spreadsheet, because you have a circuit in your brain that's going to take care of that for you as long as you eat foods that have normal satiety.
So a lot of people are on Twitter, you talk about individual foods. This is in build up to your app eventually coming out later on this year that people can sign up for. Is there a wait list that people can join from our audience?
Yeah, sure. You can go to hava.co and sign up for the wait list to get early access to it. But it's not available yet.
Not available yet, but they can eventually go and sign up for it. In the meantime, as people are looking at some of the content that you're putting out there, foods that are less satiating, more satiating, people typically are putting together meals. And as they're putting out of the meals, those meals comprise of individual sort of components. So are there, from your perspective, because I'm sure you imagine everybody is very curious about what does the doctor eat himself? Not that you are advocating how you eat for everybody else. And you've said many times, there's a lot of different ways that people can end up eating healthy and follow the principles that make sense to them. But what would be some ways that you are having a high satiety breakfast, for example, that fits your dietary personality, right? Just as an example, not that this is a prescription for everybody else, but just what does a high satiety breakfast look like for you in your own life?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I often don't even eat breakfast in the weekdays, but I eat in the weekends. And I mean, a lot of eggs, I would say, fried or boiled, and something else I eat a lot of is some version of low-fat Greek yogurt, you know, high protein and pretty low calories. And then I have some berries or chopped apple, and then coffee, of course. I have to have coffee.
Speaking of coffee, back in the day, you used to drink a lot as you were starting down the low-carb movement. You would have a lot of, you know, there's a whole trend of people adding butter to their coffee or MCT oil. Tell us, why did you stop that process?
Yeah, I think that's probably a pretty major mistake, unless you really need all that energy. And I would argue most people today do not. Certainly not if you want to lose weight. Don't put butter in your coffee. I would drink it black or with a little bit of milk. It's my suggestion. But yeah, it's a huge amount of added fats that most people don't need today.
Got it. So you gave this presentation at, I believe it was Low Carb Denver, and you talked about sort of like your, you know, like a typical salad that you might have for lunch, right? Can you break that down? And what are the factors that are part of it that lead to a high satiety score that leave you in a place personally where you've said, you know, you eat a meal and you're content. You don't search around for a lot of different things. Sure, you're a human being like anybody else. I'm sure there's days where you're more stressed out, where you might want to reach for something or emotional eating or that. We all have a little bit, but generally your baseline is set up in a way that you don't overeat and you're generally feeling content. So that salad that you typically would make, what does that mean?
Yeah, but any salad really with a lot of protein in it would be a good choice. I mean, for me, could be a lot of chicken salads, but it doesn't have to be that. It could be anything that is high protein. I'm actually quite fond of some vegetarian protein options as well, beans and edamame beans, perhaps. It's really fascinating how they are really among the highest satiety foods you can eat. So that's a tip. A high protein salad, anything you like.
You know, your work is getting people away from counting calories, but do you feel that it's important, or how do you think of the context of macros? For example, high protein for somebody could mean something else, could mean different for other people. We've had multiple guests on this podcast talk about, you know, try to get, you know, in America here, you know, try to get a gram of, you know, protein per healthy body weight. If you're overweight or if you're already lean, you know, trying to get a gram for that. How do you think about macros in the conversation of satiety? You're telling people, you know, prioritize protein as part of this matrix that are there. Is there a target amount of protein that you're trying to have people reach?
I think a gram per pound is a good general rule if people are tracking, but I think most people are not really. So I really want to find ways to make this very, very simple. And since most people are not counting how many grams of protein they eat every day, I think it's more interesting to look at, or simpler, to look at what foods are high protein as a percentage of the calories, which often is, well, it's one of the main factors that drive this satiety per calorie. So if you eat foods that you know are higher satiety, generally they are also higher in protein, and you're not going to be low in protein if you base your foods on higher satiety, higher protein foods. You're going to eat probably more protein than you did when you started, by quite a bit. But again, if you want to have a number, yeah, gram per pound, sure.
I mean, the most simplistic approach, and that's obviously tough for a lot of us that were in the space of trying to figure out, you know, all these different things that we had to do to optimize or backtrack from a particular way of eating. And I love that simple approach. And really, do you feel that the core essence of it is like, hey, evolutionarily, we've made it this far up until, let's say, the industrialization of food, we survived.
Nobody counted
it without disease.
Nobody counted.
Nobody counted calories. Nobody was tracking protein.
Nobody tracked protein
and in a
grams.
Way, they were intuitively eating because they had to based on the environment, so we're just trying to return to that. That's the answer for people.
Yeah, exactly, because you find all these populations that none of them counted calories, none of them counted protein grams or carb grams or anything, and yet obesity was non-existent. Hypertension, cardiovascular disease, mostly non-existent. They got a cut and got infected, and then they died from that. That's a bummer. They got hit on the head, and no hospital, you die. So they didn't necessarily always live as long as we do. But when they did, and some people did live long and happy lives, they were free of our chronic diseases. And I think that's pretty fascinating, because it tells me that we could have both. Of course, we have antibiotics, we have hospitals, we have all of these things, right? What if we could also have health as we age and be free of these chronic diseases of aging that we get? Then we could have the best of both worlds. We could live long and happy, healthy lives. So I want to be part of contributing to that in whatever small way I can. I think that's pretty amazing, the possibilities.
So while you and your team are finishing up the app, and you'll put it out, you know, sometime maybe later on this year, early next year, and we'll link in the show notes where people can sign up for the waitlist. Let's leave the audience with a few kind of core principles of things that they get excited about this conversation. They want to prioritize satiety. They're eating some level of processed foods in their life, which is, you know, going to be my audience here. Not everybody, even myself, you know, not everything I made is cooked at home. I'll still go to Whole Foods and pick up some of the boxed and bagged, you know, different items. So while we don't have the ability to scan our food in the meantime, because the app is not here, do you want to leave our audience with a few sort of core principles that they could really help to kind of think about, how do I apply satiety in my matrix of eating right now?
Yeah, I think a core thing is try to eat more protein rich foods as a way to get satiety, as a way to not be so hungry and not have so many cravings for less healthy foods. If you load up on protein early in the morning is good. If you have breakfast, eat a high protein breakfast. What does that mean? Maybe 30 grams of protein or more. What are good sources of that? Well, you know, eggs, good source. Another thing that I mentioned that I'm partial to is low-fat Greek yogurt, very, very high protein as a percentage. Can't go wrong with that. And whatever you want with it, basically. More protein. And of course,
can I mention
try
one
to,
thing about the protein? Just sorry to interrupt you. You shared it in your presentation, but I forgot what the theory or the thesis is, but that there was a group of researchers that feel that the search for protein is maybe one of the reasons why people overeat, because they're not getting enough protein. Can you explain this a little bit for our audience?
Yeah, it's a fascinating theory. The two professors called Robin Hubbard and Simpson, they've done a lot of exciting studies on this called the protein leverage hypothesis. And what they say is, humans and really any animal, we eat for two specific reasons. One is to get the nutrients that our body needs. This is the thing that builds our bodies, right? Which is basically protein and vitamins that come together with protein. The other thing we need is energy that makes us able to move and think and do all the things we do. So nutrients to build our bodies and energies to run them. And the energy comes from carbohydrates and fat. And the nutrients come together with protein. It is protein and comes together with protein. Now, what happens is that humans and other animals tend to eat until we get a certain amount of nutrients, a certain amount of protein. That is kind of what we need. We can't store enormous amounts of this, so we kind of need it every day, which means that we end up trying to eat at least as much as we need every day. And what happens is that if the food you're eating is nutrient diluted, if it's mostly just carbohydrates and fat, then you will have to eat much more of both nutrients and energy in order to get the nutrients you need. You end up eating more energy. Now, that's exactly what's been happening to our food supply. In order to make it more profitable and cheaper to produce, we've just poured massive amounts of sugar and oil into our processed food supply, which dilutes the nutrients, dilutes the protein. And according to this theory, it just forces us, we don't even have a choice really, it forces us to eat more to get the nutrients, the protein that we need. And then we end up eating more energy every day on average because it's been nutrient diluted. It's got low nutrient density, if you will. And this is one of the factors that we factor into the satiety formula. It's one of the most powerful factors.
Beautiful. Well, I interrupted you while you were leaving the audience with some takeaways here as we sort of wind down. You mentioned protein. You also gave the background on that. Thank you for that. Were there other couple items you wanted to leave them with?
Yeah, I mean, be extra careful, of course, with high sugar foods. I mean, I'm sure all you guests say that. And high sugar and high fat combinations are the worst, right? High carb, high fat combinations, if you can avoid that, that's a good idea.
Yeah, and there's a lot of health foods that are in that category that fit that mold. So even healthy foods that are like healthy concoctions of things, you know, high sugar, high fat, that is what I personally see. Even, you know, living here in Los Angeles, we have so many great stores, grocery stores, Air One. I don't know if you've heard of that before, but that's a great place out here. There's a lot of high sugar, high fat foods that are there because they taste great. And there's ways to do it, making it organic and this. Fine, we can have a little bit of that in our lives. But when the base of our diet is those types of foods that are out there, it makes it much easier to overeat.
Yeah, well, start your day with protein and then make sure you get enough. And that really, I think, for a lot of people can be the number one thing that really makes it a lot easier to be less hungry, have less cravings, and it would be easier to choose a better choose better options.
Well, Dr. E, this has been great. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast, laying out your satiety approach. Any way that our audience can keep in touch with you and your work, where do you want to send them as you and your team are building this app and they want to follow along and pay attention to the other really cool things you're up to?
Yeah, you can find us on all the social networks, hava.co, and I'm pretty active on Twitter. So if you want to interact with me or ask me anything, I'll probably reply. So at Dr. E on Twitter. Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you for being on the podcast. Super appreciate you.
Thank you, Drew. It was a pleasure to be here.
Hi, everyone. Drew here. Two quick things. Number one, thank you so much for listening to this podcast. If you haven't already subscribed, just hit the subscribe button on your favorite podcast app. And by the way, if you love this episode, it would mean the world to me. And it's the number one thing that you can do to support this podcast is share it with a friend. Share with a friend who would benefit from listening. Number two, before I go, I just had to tell you about something that I've been working on that I'm super excited about. It's my weekly newsletter, and it's called Try This. Every Friday, yes, every Friday, 52 weeks a year, I send out an easy-to-digest protocol of simple steps that you or anyone you love can follow to optimize your own health. We cover everything from nutrition to mindset to metabolic health, sleep, community, longevity, and so much more. If you want to get on this email list, which is, by the way, free, and get my weekly step-by-step protocols for whole body health and optimization, click the link in the show notes that's called Try This, or just go to drewperowhit.com, that's drewperohit.com, and click on the tab that says Try This.